How does an independent artist make it in today's music industry without a big fancy record contract or any kind of college degree? The answer? Welcome to the Musician Mastery Podcast.
Tired of Ticketmaster? Well, so is my guest today on Talk Mastery. His name is Jacob Duquette, and he's got a nonprofit that I really want you guys to hear about. And he's also done all kinds of different jobs, like anything you can think of on the production side, Jacob has done. So I look forward to you guys learning from his years of experience in today's interview. Check it out.
I run a not-for-profit that's kind of at the very early stages right now. And, you know, I do a lot of other stuff like production work I've been running a business since 2017.
Nice.
Been in the industry for 22 years. So I do a lot of stuff. But happy to just talk about whatever you want to talk about. If you want to talk about ticketing and that kind of stuff, sure.
Yeah. I think it'd be kind of cool because there was some stuff that happened in the news recently.
Yeah.
Where I think it was Avenged Sevenfold.
Oh, I haven't heard about that one.
Okay, so Ticketmaster and Avenged Sevenfold, Avenged Sevenfold, I think it was 2 years ago, they put out the Deathbat Club, which had some NFTs mm-hmm. that fans could get access to, and they got all kinds of really cool perks from it. Well, apparently recently they tested that whole NFT thing with Ticketmaster. And I think they said something like it had a 10% conversion rate for the people that owned the crypto and that okay. were buying the tickets. And they were like talking about how that was like really huge and like, oh my gosh, we've 10% conversion rates and all this kind of stuff. And I was curious, you know, what your thoughts were on NFTs and ticketing. Because I made a video not too long
sure,
ago.
Sure, yeah.
I just kind of lightly threw out there like, okay, well, there's different solutions to the whole ticket scalping thing, and one yeah. of them could potentially be like an NFT type structure.
Absolutely, yeah.
And dude, so many people were like, no! why are you doing this? This is a scam!
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what are your thoughts on doing the NFT with the ticketing thing?
NFTs get a bum rap, right? Because you see like the fucking ape shit and, you know, tech bros just, you know, grifting. But all an NFT is a way to make a digital sale, and it's backed up on the blockchain as a secure way of exchanging goods and services for cryptocurrency or even cash, because you can mm-hmm. do like cash conversions and stuff like that. The different things you can make an NFT has a lot of potential for sales, even outside of ticketing, just like selling yeah. a car or selling a house. You know, there's like incalculable ways. Like, we're just scratching yeah. the surface of this whole technology. So, like, of course, there's solutions in the blockchain for ticketing.
Yeah, I think it's like you said, it kind of gets a bum rap. I think one of the best ways I heard, there's a tax attorney named Mark J. Kohler that I follow, and he talks about NFTs as like two separate categories. He calls them CNFTs and UNFTs. And okay. the CNFT is a collectible. So that's kind of like what you were talking about, like with the Bored Apes and that, and like anything that's kind of art, you know, yeah. that, or just some kind of commodity that has its value based on the perception of the person buying it. So it could be like trading cards or an actual car or whatever, right? But then the UNFT, that's the utility NFT. And so that, to me, that's kind of like what Avenged Sevenfold is doing, where by owning this NFT, you get access to things that are useful to you as a fan. And that's kind of where the utility comes yeah. into for the NFT. And I've always thought that like the collectible side of the NFT world can get pretty like shady, you know, but to me, I think the real bright future for them is going to be the UNFTs, because having a way to verify something on the blockchain is so valuable. Like, it hasn't been implemented wide scale across, you know, yeah. everywhere yet. But I think in the next, it could be 15 to 20, it could be 5 to 10. I think that we're going to see a lot more of our regular daily things get integrated onto blockchain. And I think ticketing Absolutely. Is going to be one of those things that's really helpful. And Ticketmaster is already trying this. So yeah, like with Avenged Sevenfold, they got together, and for their tour that's coming up to back their new record, they were experimenting, and apparently they've been seeing pretty good results with the people who had it.
Yeah, yeah. Right now, there's three companies I know of. I couldn't name you the companies off the top of my head, but through my research, there's three different companies that are kind of scratching this ticketing NFT world. Okay. And countless other people scratching the NFT world in different aspects. I had Gord Pryor on my podcast, I think last month, and he is in a digital distribution company, and they're based here in Canada, and they have been, you know, doing NFTs and album sales and putting together, like, you know, physical copies of albums, CDs, cassettes, even with the NFT stuff. And like, when you're talking about this, what is it, UNFT, you said?
Yeah.
So the utility part of it is, you know, once they sell that NFT, that's not necessarily the end of the transaction. You know, through that NFT, you can add content to that at any time, and then whoever purchased that would have access to it. So there's a lot of cool, interesting ways that you could implement NFTs through ticketing. Now, right now, it's fairly expensive to do because it's a new technology. So as more people start adopting it and the price of minting comes down, then you're going to see a lot more of this. It's going to be much more commonplace. And, you know, it's just education for the consumers, right? And like, you know, erasing that stigma that an NFT isn't just some grifter selling you an ape for, you know, a ridiculous amount of money that you'll never see a profit off of.
Exactly. You'll never really see a value exchange.
But to go into what you said too about like the like collectible part of the NFT, the collectible world has always been like that. Like, I used to collect hockey cards growing up. I used to collect Pogs. Like, I'm an old motherfucker. So, you know, I had Pogs, and like, you know, people sold these things for ridiculous amounts of money, you know, and like, now are they worth that? Maybe. To somebody.
But
that's all a collectible is, you know, and it's like, you know,
yeah, that's like,
grifters are going to grift, you know?
Yeah, that is true. Grifters are going to grift no matter what the grift is. They're just looking for anyway. My singer, Gabriel, funny enough, he started collecting Beyblades from back in the day. Those
things were, I don't know what that is.
That's like, I mean, I'm not super, I remember them being called things like Tops, I think. But like,
you could, like a little spinny thing.
Yeah, you pull it and it like starts spinning and stuff. So he started collecting that, and he was saying that there were some that were on sale for like $50 and some that were on sale for like $200. And it's like, yeah, like for somebody who doesn't see any value in that, they could go like, why would someone pay $200 for that? But for someone who's in that world, $200 may be a good price for them.
Heck yeah, man.
So like you said, like, the whole, people are like, oh, that's so shady with NFTs and collectibles. I'm like, man, like you said, that's been true with collectibles, period.
Yeah.
You know, so nothing's only, the only thing that's changing is it's being moved onto a digital landscape.
Yeah.
You know? Now, the NFT ticketing thing, that was kind of, what would you call it? It's like a solution people are trying to put forward because they're tired of Ticketmaster's ridiculous excess fees on everything. Fees on fees on fees on fees.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you put together, you're putting together a solution to kind of help with artists and ticketing. I'd love to hear a little bit more in detail from your perspective about what that process looks like.
Sure. I can't talk about anything in any kind of, I guess, detail, because we're still in the development phase. There's a few. Let me talk about the issues I see with ticketing first. You know, when you go on to any website, it doesn't matter which one it is, Ticketmaster, Eventbrite, SeatGeek, all of the ones. They're all the same, right? It's just right now, Ticketmaster is the big dog in the junkyard, right?
Yeah.
So the problem I see with ticketing is twofold. One, transparency in the ticket sale itself. I think people want to see where the money is going, who's taking that money, and that goes for the artist too, not just the consumer. There just needs to be transparency across the board to where these fees are going. Because with any service, you know, Ticketmaster does provide a service. They need to be paid for that service. And I don't fault them for doing that. What I fault them for is the you know, clouded ways that they go about doing the business, and the extra fees, and the creating false supply issues with their ticketing, right? The way they like put blocks of seats on sale to like maximize profits, and then put another block on. There's a class action lawsuit happening here in Canada with Drake tickets right now. Somebody bought tickets for the Montreal show. They were sold as a premium ticket at like $800 Canadian, so that's like $3 US. And then the next day, Ticketmaster put a second show on sale. So, you know, you being an artist, you know that, you know, when you're booked for something, you're booked before it's on sale. So Drake knew, Ticketmaster knew, and they created a false supply
scare. It's like false scarcity.
Exactly. You know? So there's all sorts of stuff like that. And then the fees, you know, like where are those fees going? Are they going to Ticketmaster or are they going to the venue? Because, you know, both of those places need to make money, but where is it going? And Ticketmaster being a artist manager, a promoter, a venue operator, a venue owner, and the ticketing service, when you get into a venue that's Live Nation owned, a lot of that money is going to wherever. And if Live Nation's acting as a promoter as well, a promoter typically is that person between the venue and the artist management, and the promoter, to kind of like make sure everything's on the level, you know. But if Ticketmaster is the promoter and venue owner, then they're going to say, okay, so the band needs, like, I don't know if you watched the Ticketmaster hearing, but
I saw a couple of clips, but not the full
thing. The artist that was there, I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but he was talking about towel rental, right? So, you know, when you go into a venue, you need stage towels, right?
Yeah.
Get sweaty up there. So I guess they were talking about like an $800 fee for these stage towels. Now, if it was so as Live Nation being the promoter and the venue owner, they're just going to run that fee through. But if there was like an independent promoter that's renting a venue from somebody else, and the venue is like $800 for towels, the promoter is going to be like, fuck you. I'll just go buy 20 towels from Walmart, and it'll cost like, you know, what it costs, you know? So there's shitloads of problems with that. And just like the way that Live Nation Ticketmaster has both horizontal and vertical growth in the industry, and that they control so much, they're able to do all of these non-transparent things. And that needs to be looked at. So what I'm doing is just simply, you know, being open, honest about transactions. And that's, you know, not just in the music industry, but I think that's important everywhere.
Absolutely.
So for ticketing specifically, one of the things that is a huge problem, but also a huge advantage to the consumer, is ticket transferability, right? So because ticket transferability is a thing, these resellers have been able to, you know, put, I think it's a $6 or $7 billion industry together on these secondary sales. Now you can't just say no refunds, no transferability, because, you know, people spend a lot of money on this kind of thing, and if they get sick or something comes up and they can't go, they can't get off work, whatever, they're going to be out, you know, $600 to $800 or more. So you need the transferability. So in that comes the challenge of, well, how do we sell the tickets without, you know, allowing these secondary sellers to, you know, leech off of the industry and the consumer. So here comes in NFTs, where it offers a solution of transferability, you know, and, you know, you can put it through a portal. Ticketmaster has been kind of getting a little bit better at this now that they've been scolded by the entire country. And like using the transferability through their site directly, so a lot of these secondary sellers can't you know, tap into that market. But yeah, there's so many ways to skin a cat, right? And, you know, now that it's in the public eye, you know, things have started to look better, but it's really only a matter of time before people catch on and start, you know, taking advantage of the new systems in place.
Yeah. And I think that's something that like not a lot of people understand quite in depthly is that like Live Nation on the surface seems like a totally separate company from Ticketmaster, but they are very much, and I guess they are.
Ticketmaster is owned and under the Live Nation umbrella.
Exactly. They don't realize that it's kind of like the big corporate structure where Live Nation is at the top and then just owns Ticketmaster. And that to me is something that has been kind of like disconcerting because it feels like, you know, you're building, basically it's a monopoly, you know?
And the term monopoly is, you know, open to the interpretation of the law, right?
Sure.
So, you know, in 2010 is when the merger happened. Uh-huh. You know, there were discussions back then of like how this would affect the industry as a whole,
yeah,
and how it would affect consumers. And, you know, all of these things have come true. The competition has dwindled. The ticket prices have gone up. The mm-hmm. fees have gone up. And the level of service that Live Nation as a promoter and Ticketmaster as a ticket seller provide are dwindling as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the potato chip thing, right? You used to get a full bag of potato chips, and now it's mostly air. Yep. It's the same thing with Ticketmaster and Live Nation. You know, like I've been in the music industry as a production worker for over 20 years. And I used to make, I still do because I've diversified what I do. Yeah. But in the music industry, you used to be able to make a really good living working for promoters. And now they'll basically get the cheapest, youngest intern that they can get to run a show as a promoter rep. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, they would hire somebody like me who has a bunch of experience, who knows all the all the contacts, all of the venues, all of the, you know, collective bargaining agreements with unions and the larger venues. And now it's, you know, you get this intern who's just there and they get some paperwork in front of them for a show and they have no idea what any of it means. And they just kind of roll with it. Right. So,
yeah.
You know, like every industry, the services are going down, the prices are going up. It's the, like I said, it's that horizontal and vertical growth of Live Nation Ticketmaster. That's just, it may not be a monopoly, but they certainly can act like a monopoly.
Yeah.
Especially in that like higher tier of performance, right?
Yeah.
When you get into these 1,000+ seat venues, you know, they control about 80% of the large shows and sporting events, not just music.
And that's a crazy thing because most people, like, they go to their, you know, their local arena that's in their town or maybe a big theater or something, and at first glance it just kind of seems like, yeah, this is the place that we have that's in our hometown, but not realizing it's like you said, 80% of those venues across the country are owned by one company, you know, and they set the rules and kind of, if you don't like it, well, tough, you know?
Yeah. And like there's, and so say you're talking about like a small market out, like say somewhere in Minneapolis, right? You go to a little theater in Minneapolis. It might be owned by the city. It might be operated by the city, but mm-hmm. they have a contract with Ticketmaster to sell tickets, right? And that there, it's an exclusive contract. They're not able to sell tickets any other way other than Ticketmaster.
So if I understand that correctly, sorry to cut you off there.
Sure.
So what you're saying is that Ticketmaster basically gets exclusive rights to venues from the states, basically making
if they're operated by the state. Typically they're operated by like a municipal government. And it's with any venue, it can be independently owned, it can be a government, private.
Yeah, yeah. Because they could definitely pull that same kind of strategy with someone who just owns a venue.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, so it doesn't have to be necessarily, but that's it kind of just shows you the depth that they go to make sure that they are the only ticket providers or the only people promoting these massive gigs from the big artists.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, and there's lots of ways that they kind of will give the benefits to people who are selling tickets, especially larger venues. It's kind of like shitty Robin Hood, as I call it, where they take from the poor and give to the rich.
Yeah.
If you were, say, for example, you owned a 400 person venue, you're independently owned and operated, and you got into a deal with Ticketmaster, right? So mm-hmm. they're going to sell your tickets. They're going to charge you as a promoter and venue owner to use this service, right? Now, what they do with their large clients, they don't have that same kind of deal with their large clients, and I'm talking like Beyonce and stuff mm-hmm. like that. They'll typically manage a lot of these artists that go into these giant arenas and stadiums. But say if somebody is like promoting a lot of tickets, they will actually pay those fees in advance to these venues to get that contract. So they're taking all of these small venues, charging all of these excess fees, and then just giving that to these giant corporate clients that sell a whole bunch of tickets.
Wow. So they're using the money that they, I mean, for lack of a better phrase, that they're milking from the smaller venues to go and get contracts with the bigger ones.
Exactly. Man,
it's a very shady business model that's gone on for years and years and years. And it's funny, you know, you hear about, you know, this kind of, it's kind of become a meme now where they talk about how Pearl Jam warned us about this in the 90s.
Yeah, they did.
You know, it's been
about 25 years ago.
Literally, yeah, 25 years ago. And you know, you figure that these kind of conversations would be happening more in depth back then and solutions would come to you, but like, it also shows you that depending on, you know, the country or whatever, governments that are open to receive financial support from big businesses, that always opens up a dirty, slippery slope.
Yeah,
you know, to basically guarantee the interests of the big corporations as opposed to the interests of the common person.
100%.
So
yeah, the lobbying is a thing that happens in every industry, and ticketing and live events is not distant from that at all. You see it like right now, like a lot of, like, I watched the entire Live Nation hearing, and a lot of people don't really watch that kind of stuff, but I think a lot of people started watching the TikTok one. I'm sure you've seen clips online about, you know, all of these politicians talking about TikTok, and maybe back in the day, like, I can't remember when, but when Facebook kind of went through the exact same thing, you see that a lot of these politicians know absolutely nothing about the industry they're making laws against.
Exactly.
And they are literally just taking what somebody else has given them, which is from a lobbyist group, and they're, you know, trying to implement that.
Yeah, making decisions based off that information.
Yeah. So when the lobbyist group that they're trying to make changes on is literally the people they're trying to, you know, get to change.
Exactly.
It's a huge problem, right? And like, I think right now there's the Fair Ticketing Act, FAIR. This has been lobbied by Live Nation Ticketmaster. They're basically like, you know, they've been scolded by the public and by certain government officials, and now they're kind of choosing their own punishment, really.
I was about to say, yeah, it's picking the way that which they're policed.
Yeah.
So effectively.
And like, there's been laws like this before, like there's like the Bots Act, which hasn't done anything really. There's all these laws that get passed with, like, you know, fair trade and like all sorts of different things. But you know, when you're a huge multi-billion-dollar company like Live Nation, you can tie things up in litigation for years, and a lot of the times the governments are just, they can't go after you for these things because, one, it costs a lot of money, and two, if they fail, then that sets a legal precedence for them to continue. So what they do is they kind of tie them up in these hearings, like you see, like the Live Nation one, the TikTok one, and they try to, you know, make changes in that way, that aren't necessarily a law, but it helps the situation, and that's really all they can do. Like, they can't yeah. You know, they can't take things to court. They like Ticketmaster just won the last legal battle they were in. I can't remember which one it was about, but there's a bunch of them. But
yeah,
they
won. They're running into that a lot.
Yeah, and like in the Ticketmaster hearing, one of the people actually was saying like we literally can't take this to a court because, you know, it's too much money and we could fail.
Wow. Man, that's crazy that it literally has got to this position, but at least there are people out there that are trying to do something about it. You know, there's, you know,
yeah,
like people like yourself and, you know, others that are out there trying to figure out alternatives that don't have to involve these big giant corporations. And I think ultimately that is, you know, that can only go for so long, I feel. You know, like at some point the people, I think that's really when the big change happens, is when the people by and large en masse become aware and educated about really what the problems are.
Absolutely.
Because then they're willing to put their money in other solutions. But we're creatures of habit and comfort. So if we've probably bought in our lifetime tens or maybe for some hundreds of tickets through Ticketmaster, if that's what they're just used to doing, then they don't really want to try the new thing. They don't want to try the NFT. They don't want that because it's just, it breaks what they're used to. But I think once people by and large become aware that, like, listen, you know, you don't have to pay these giant fees, yeah, you know, like, and that's something too that I was kind of like curious about with your, you know, nonprofit that you're building, which is me and my band. We've thought about ways of like, man, would it be more beneficial to go to venues directly and see if you can't, yes, negotiate some kind of thing where the band is responsible for selling the tickets, like, you know, through their website or something.
100% yes.
I feel like,
yeah,
even if the band had to pay an upfront fee to like rent out the, yep, venue, if they got to reap the rewards of, yep, the ticket sales, of a percentage of the bar, they get their merchandise, you know, all these different things, I feel like it'd be very possible for a, yes, band to not just break even, but actually make some decent money. Kind of in a sense being the promoter for their own shows.
Absolutely. I've talked about this on my podcast. I've talked about this with other people, with bands that I work with, especially on that indie level where, you know, people are self-managing. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like the DIY thing. I was talking about this with Eamon McGrath, who's a independent artist. He's toured all over the world. And he is probably one of the most DIY people I know. He's a really smart guy. He knows when to bring a band with him. He knows when to play a solo show. He knows how to maximize, his profitability on touring. And, if you don't know who Eamon McGrath is, you should check him out and see what he's doing. And especially here in Canada, cause he's a Canadian artist. And, what a lot of people don't realize about Canada is, it is fucking hard to tour here, man. You know, yeah, like in the US, you know, you can drive, you know, an hour in almost any direction and you're going to be in another market. Mm-hmm. Here in Canada, between, say, Sault Ste. Marie, which is a super small market, to Winnipeg, Manitoba, that's a fucking drive, man. We're talking like 10 hours
of driving. Yeah. I have a band that I've toured with before. They're from Canada. Their name's the Beer Union.
Okay.
And they're all the way over in BC, right? Or no, yeah, yeah. Or maybe they're in Vancouver. I think they're in British Columbia.
Vancouver is British Columbia. It's on the West Coast. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So forgive me. I'm not, it's super fine, well in depth with my Canadian provinces as I should be.
Nobody cares about Canada. It's fine.
I know Newfoundland because it's on Trailer Park Boys.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, I have seen that, like, they've gone through these tours where they'll take weeks off in between because just those to take that all on one run to, yeah, go from like all the way of West Canada all the way to like, let's say, Toronto or something. It's just, you kind of just don't want to do that.
Cause, no, like, there's a lot of road in between the markets here in Canada. It's not like the US. It's not like Europe. It is really, really hard to tour in Canada and be successful and be profitable.
Anybody in America, if you've ever tried to tour through Texas, just imagine if every state was like Texas.
That's a really good example, actually.
Yeah,
that's a really, really good example.
Because, yeah, in Texas, you drive 5 hours in any direction, you're still in Texas.
Yeah.
You're like, what? It looks kind of different, but no, I'm still here, you know. Yeah. But yeah, I could see how that could definitely be more like your tours when you're doing Canadian runs, even if you're in Canada, they're like hyper localized, you know, maybe to one province.
Yeah, so typically when people come to Canada, say they won't stay in Canada. They'll do, like, if they're, say, in New York, they'll come up to Southern Ontario and they'll do maybe like, you know, Toronto and maybe some of the, like, the larger markets around Toronto. Mm-hmm. There's a few. There's definitely smaller markets. Like, a big city in Canada is not like a big city in the US. Like, our population is very small, and most of it, 90% of it, is in Southern Ontario. You know, like a 6 hour or less drive from the Rainbow Bridge in Buffalo to Niagara Falls, Ontario.
Wow.
Right. So that's where like 90% of the population of Canada lives. So to get to those other 10% of Canada, which is not a lot, is a lot of people just don't see value in it. A lot of people don't, or just can't afford to do it. Right. What'll happen is, like, they'll, if they're in New York, they'll pop over the border to play Toronto. And then, you know, if they're in Seattle, they'll pop up to play Vancouver, kind of thing.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense too, especially if, like, if you're a U.S. touring band and you want to hit the Canadian markets, but like to do a Canadian run, like you said, there's those logistic issues. So it's like, it makes a lot of sense to find a U.S. market that you can hit relatively easy and then just kind of hop over the border, come back down, and then kind of go on your way inside the States, so to speak. Yeah.
But to answer your posed question about whether it's viable for artists to, you know, purchase their own, rent their own venue, sell their own tickets, like, mm-hmm. absolutely, yes. Like I kind of got off topic with talking about it, like, the way to do it, but the you know, if you play a market, say your home market, for example, it's the easiest one to do. Yep. Right, you already have a fan base, so like, why are you, you know, waiting for somebody else to pay you to go play or sell your tickets? Rent a hall, get a PA, and put on the show yourself. Get a temporary liquor license, sell your own beer, get a beer sponsor. They'll probably give you the beer for free to do it. Nice. And then you're selling your own beer, you're selling your own tickets. And that's really, really easy to do in your home market. You know, and then, you know, maybe in a market that you play a lot, you know, and you're selling tickets, then you can add that to your, you know, self-promotion list of cities that you can do.
It's kind of like
you keep adding to that and keep adding to that, right?
Yeah.
The more you play, the more feasible it becomes to do this and less of a risk.
Yes. Because, yeah, like, for me, I live in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So for me, traveling down to Dallas is kind of like a real near market to us. Mm-hmm. It's like, I see that's a really nice logical thing for a band to do. It's like, okay, I'm going to play in my hometown and I'll use other promoters until I build up my own following. Then I'll book my own gigs, promote my own gigs, and then do the same thing in a regional market where you go, okay, well, I'm going to have a promoter that I know help get me hooked up for a few shows or more down here in Dallas. Once I do that enough to where people are just coming, then I'll just rent my own gig. So that seems like a really cool little system that indie artists can utilize to help sort of
100%.
And I know for some artists, it's like, it's a little bit nerve wracking to take on that sort of entrepreneurial side of the business, but man, it's so worth it. You know, like, I feel like as artists, sometimes we get used to the grooves that we'll fall into sometimes, especially artists who are like starting out. Like, for instance, I think there is a huge, like, for lack of a better phrase, a fetishizing of getting guarantees. Which, don't get me wrong, when you have a crew and you've got traveling costs, guarantees are extremely important. But I feel like for a lot of bands that are starting out, door splits can be more lucrative than guarantees. I remember one time that I had, I was like, we were playing our hometown gig and the venue offered us like a $400 guarantee. And we were like, man, that's it? Like, we've been playing this for years and we can bring 100 people. Like, what's going on? So we were like, you know what, whatever, we'll just do the door deal, but we're not going to be happy about it. We're gonna moan about it.
Yeah.
We ended up making way more. I think we ended up making three times that guarantee amount from the door sales.
Yeah.
And that was like a moment that we had like 5 years ago where I was just like, and okay, I've been looking at this a little bit backwards in certain aspects. So it can be very lucrative to do the whole, like, well, we'll just make money from the ticket sales. I feel like some artists get scared though because they know
it's a risk.
It's a risk, and that they're starting out, and if they don't feel confident or just know that they don't have a huge audience, then yeah, doing it based off just, you know, the door sales can be risky.
Yeah.
So
well, knowing when to negotiate these things is a really important skill to have, and mm-hmm. developing relationships with whatever venues or promoters you're working with. So say you, like you said, you've gone into this market a few times, you know, you're putting 100 people through their door, you know, that's going to get them like, you know, $2,000-$3,000 worth of sales on their end, you know, that's a good night for them.
Yeah.
You know, so for them to pay you $400 when you're the one packing the place, you know, that's a little bit of a bum deal. Like, and I think anybody can see that.
Yeah.
So like when you recognize that as a band, now you have some negotiating power and you can say, hey, why don't you give me that $400 guarantee? But we also want that split.
Yeah.
And you can get that $400 guarantee. And then once their expenses get covered for the door person, the sound person, the whatever costs are associated, then you start splitting those ticket sales like 80-20 or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. There's lots of ways to negotiate that. And you know, it's tough to do because it's especially as an indie band, because it's so hyper competitive and like everybody wants to play. Everybody wants to play that venue. So like to, you know, stick your neck out and say, we know we fill this venue, we want a sweeter deal, you know, a lot of times people are just going to say fuck off, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and then what are you going to do, right? Now you have to find somewhere else to play. You know, there's a lot of risks involved with, like, you know trying to negotiate what you're worth. So a lot of bands just kind of fall into that like easy, risk-free way of touring, but you know, you're never going to make any money doing that.
About to say, yeah, and you have a lot of experience doing, like, with your promotion history and doing stuff on tour, because you've done tour TM work, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yeah, so yeah, like my career is kind of like weird, like Canada is so different than the US, you know, like it's such a small market, everybody knows everybody, and you know, so for me and like anyone, if you ever watch my podcast, I talk to a lot of other Canadian industry people, and we're all the same. Like we're all like, you know, an audio engineer turned tour manager turned, you know, like artist manager, just doing, because you can't make a living doing one thing as an industry professional in Canada. So, you know, I started out as an audio engineer, and like just like local crew on these big shows. You know, I'm the guy unloading the trucks for Aerosmith, right? And then through that, I got into like audio engineering, and I got into stage management, tour management, production design. So now, you know, like I have a great client list that pays me to do some really cool things. And I get paid really well for what I do. I've been, you know, all through the US touring, doing everything from music to experiential marketing events, to like big sporting ceremonies. I've never done the Olympics, but I've done like the Pan American Games, I've done the Asian Games. Nice. So like those like giant shows, and I make a great living doing that. But then there's also that part of me who is like a music nerd who loves music, and I see a lot of you know, not value, not necessarily like monetary value, but entertainment value in these smaller artists who in my opinion are just as good as the people selling out stadiums. You know, and I find that's true everywhere. You know, you go to anywhere and you see this, you go to an open mic in any city you go to, you're gonna get blown away by somebody. I like, if you're open to the experience.
Yes. So
there's always been this part of me who's, you know, gone to these shows as a fan, bought the tickets. I've promoted my own. I have shows in my driveway, in my backyard, at whatever little tiny venue I can. I even opened up my own venue years ago. I sold those shares off. But so I've my career is kind of like twofold. One, like a high level industry professional on the production side of things, but also, you know, like a small independent booker that either loses money or, you know, does things for the love of the game, right?
Yeah. And I think that's a really cool. I love how you kind of outlined your trajectory through your career, where you're like, I started in audio, and then I went to, you know, stage, and then to TM, and then production. And like, I think that's something that a lot of people who are starting out and want to be involved in this industry in some kind of capacity would do well to understand, which is that, like, it's like you take an opportunity that's in front of you. Now, like, how much, like, audio experience did you have before you took that gig? Were you already pretty well versed in, like, audio engineering, or was it kind of like, well, that's what's in front of me, I'm gonna take that?
To be honest, man, I'm a shitty audio engineer. I'm not good. I can do it, but you know, there's people who can do it way better than me. Honestly, man, if every level up, say, in my career, there's always been some amount of bullshit behind it. You know, like, it's like, yeah, I can do that. And then I just learn on the fly, right?
I think that's the way to do it, man. I think because otherwise people, we get analysis paralysis, and then we miss the opportunity that, like, I think sometimes people, they doubt their ability and the belief that they have that they could do it, you know? And so that would probably halt someone, but I think it would be good for people to realize, like, even if you don't know 100% about it, you can still take the opportunity and get good so that you can, like, get more gigs that way. You know, so I think that's a really cool story, kind of like showing that trajectory.
I think there's other ways to do it too, right? Like, you know, like, you can be a tour manager without having to, you know, be an audio engineer or like a technical person. But, you know, the bands that have like a big technical part of the show see a lot of value in somebody like me, because I understand the stage aspect of it and the show part of it, rather than just like the back end side, like the merch sales, the contracts and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Now, you could do the same thing, but start on the lower end of that, right? So you can start as like a PA or like a merch person. And, you know, get to know the back end of the business that way and work your way up to a TM, where, you know, somebody who, you know, might not have a super technical show, but are pumping merch out the door like you wouldn't believe, would see more value in somebody like that than somebody like me. So there's a lot of different ways to get into the industry, to get up to like a tour manager level, you know, not just necessarily like copying what I say, but.
Everyone will probably have their own unique trajectory through those multiple things. But I think it's cool to see that like you don't necessarily, it's like if your main goal, let's say someone who's watching this, their main goal is to be a TM for a big band. It's like, don't feel like if you don't immediately start out as a TM that you're not going to be a TM one day. You know, start where the opportunities are in front of you, and then network. And I think that's really the huge crucial thing, is when you get those opportunities that are just kind of like, oh, well, you know, this is available, it's like, I'll take it. And then you just meet everybody, because then that's where the next opportunity comes from. Like you said, to like level up.
Yeah.
You know, so that's
And don't be afraid to work back either. You know, you know, like there's lots of times in my career where I've been a successful production and tour manager for probably about 10 years now. That's the bulk of my work. But, you know, I have a gig coming up in April, at the end of April, where I'm just stage managing like an award show, which is, you know, not as involved as what I normally do. But, you know, the client is client that I haven't worked with too much, but they're a huge client. So, you know, to go nail a stage management gig, you know, will open up doors for other things down the road.
Absolutely.
Even like if I'm at a level higher than that, it's, you know, beneficial to,
you can see it as kind of an investment.
Exactly. 100%.
And I think that's a good way. I think musicians especially, we should view a lot of stuff as investments, and if it makes sense as an investment.
Yeah.
You know, this is where, like, on TikTok, you know, we both make good TikTok content, I think, and have some.
Oh, thank you. I think mine sucks, but I like yours, man.
Well, thank you.
I hate TikTok so much.
Initially, man, I hated doing TikToks. I hated them initially. There is an app that I've used recently that is, it makes me more excited to use TikTok because not necessarily because it makes TikTok any better, but it makes my business systems easier. So repurpose.io. is a, okay. is a wonderful software that I use that helps me. I can pick where I produce it. So I can, set it where I make an Instagram piece of content, and then the AI will take the Instagram and push it to wherever. I just happen to set it up with TikTok, because the video editing, like when you're actually making the video, I find it to be pretty smooth. So gotcha. As shorthand, I use TikTok, and once I make it, it takes about an hour or so, and the AI just spits it everywhere for me.
Cool.
But as far as the app itself, it, you know, that doesn't help make TikTok any better, but it makes life easier for creators like us.
Yeah. I've worked on kind of streamlining my workflow when it comes to that. You know, I've designed my, just like when you look at my podcast, just the way it's set up is, you know, it looks good, but also it's set up so I can make an Instagram square out of it. It's set up so I can make a TikTok vertical out of it. You know, and then I do all that in Adobe. I'd like to see this AI thing that automates it, though. Please send me that link.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, dude. I got you. Yeah. And I think that is something too, that artists should take advantage of, or just anybody in the industry should take advantage of is AI. You know, a lot of people, there's a lot of doom and gloom around AI, but I think that happens with any groundbreaking technology, you know, like I think about the internet. I think about crypto in a sense, you know, which I didn't get to bring this up when we were talking about NFTs and stuff, but it's like this history repeats itself, you know, kind of thing where in 2000 or so, I was five, but some people were a little bit older than five in 2000 and may remember that there was the whole dot-com bubble. You know, everyone was like, wow, this internet thing, like we're going to be able to sell things on the internet. And there were all these scammy grifters that just like, oh, I've got a good domain name. And then they'd go out and get investors. And it was kind of shady. And there were lots of people like, man, this whole internet thing is a fad. It's, you see all those scammers out there. That's not going to last forever. That's going to go away. And then sure enough, that did happen. There was a blow up. But what was left out afterwards? Well, you had Apple, you had Amazon, you had eBay, you had all these big, huge tech conglomerates that we know is like the standard that came out of that era where everyone was so skeptical about the internet. I think the same is going to happen with NFTs. I feel like, you know, we're in the grifter stage where there's a whole bunch of grifters on it, and then it blows up, and then the true technologies that are actually there to provide value will stick around for the long term.
Absolutely.
And same with AI. To get back on my point, though, like AI-generated music videos – or lyric videos.
Yep.
I've seen a couple of those where I was like, man, that's not hard to pull off, but you can get some really interesting content. Like I saw one person who used OpenAI, I think it's called DALL-E. And what they did is they typed in like one line of lyric into it, and then it spit out an image. And so they just picked the best one, saved it, and just did that for every line in the song, and then went to like iMovie or wherever and just stacked it in with the song, and now you got a cool image AI image video for your song.
Yeah.
And that can just be one piece of content that you use where, you know, you've got a live performance of the song, acoustic version of the song, AI lyric video. Yeah. Just kind of opens up a little bit more avenues that we can use to promote our music.
Yeah. So I think artists and any business, really, if you're not exploring new technology, at the very least, you're probably not going to be very successful, you know, and like, you know, just experiment with it. See what you can do.
Yeah.
You know, maybe AI isn't like the future, but, you know, right now, like you said, you can make a cool music video and that can be a TikTok post.
Yeah.
There's one post that you don't have to post tomorrow. You know, it's something. And if you're not experimenting with it and you're not experimenting with new ways to do things and being on the forefront of technology, you're just going to get left in the dust with whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I experiment with AI a lot. You know, I've used it from everything from like a creative project, like, writing, like helping with writing songs.
What's been some of your favorite, AI tools that you've used so far?
So I've experimented with a bunch of them. I've experimented with some text to image. Really, really impressive stuff. There's a lot of shit ones out there too, but the one that stood out for me was the Shutterstock one, which I believe is DALL-E driven.
Okay, cool.
ChatGPT is really, really cool.
Awesome. So what are some of the prompts that you use ChatGPT for?
So I use it for a lot of different things. One, creativity. If I'm writing something, it's like, how to give me 50 other ways I can say this. And it's like, bam, there's 50 other ways you can say it. Way better than the thesaurus or, you know, any other like tool.
That old school way.
Yeah. Yeah. I've used it for contracts, nice. Writing out NDAs, while I'm sharing this, like my not-for-profit stuff and the tech stuff with people, and then I took other NDAs that I've signed in the past and like word for word the contract, and ChatGPT pumped out a perfect NDA.
That's really interesting. That's really cool to know, because I've heard some different things that AI has got.
Don't take my advice on that. Do not go out and like make a legal document and then just be like,
it's good.
They said it was fine. Don't come at me with that. But like, if you can verify it, it's a super useful tool, not just for a creative, but for that like boring bullshit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, and like I've used it for like databasing, you know, like I've like, give me 50 venues within like a 100-meter radius of Toronto that book live music.
Oh, that's a really, like
here's 100 venues, and you can get really specific with it, and especially with ChatGPT, the more they've taken it off since, but they used to have a history tab. I think maybe if you pay for a subscription, you might get that history tab back, but the more you chat with it in a conversation, the more it learns about what you're doing. So I had this conversation going with it that had been going on for months. And whenever I asked it a question, it was so damn specific about like what I want. And you know, when you just open up a new conversation about something, it's very broad. So the more you experiment with it, the better it gets.
I see. Cause yeah, that's that machine learning type aspect of AI, which, you know, people are like, man, this is really crazy that ChatGPT-4, ChatGPT-3. I'm like, man, you need to be worried about ChatGPT-40. Like, cause that thing's going to be so smart and so good at this type of processing and of work, you know. I'm excited to how it's going to be leveraged, you know, for our favor in the future as well, though. I love the idea.
Me too.
To do like, okay, I need venues in a 25 to 100 mile radius of X city, you know. That's a really creative way. I hope musicians that are indie that watch this take that to heart and go try.
And you can do it, and like there's other, like Google Maps is available. You can use that. But like the cool thing about ChatGPT, it pumps it out on the screen there, and then you can literally just like copy paste that into a database.
Yeah.
Which is, and I think like I'm not super like computer techie. I'm pretty techie when it comes to like event production stuff, but the computer side of things, like my buddy was talking about even automating that, where I would set the parameters in my database and then the database would chat with ChatGPT to fill in all the information, and you wouldn't even have to type in what are 50 venues around this city.
It could just
it automates everything, which is a crazy tool. And like if you start thinking about the possibilities of that, it's pretty impressive.
And like you said, I think the artists that take advantage of that, and I think sometimes all it takes to be ahead is speed. Sometimes it's literally just about getting there first or getting there before most. And I think things like AI, ChatGPT specifically with the OpenAI platform and everything, I think that is going to be one of the things that helps speed up the process for a lot of artists.
Yeah.
Where others are still trying to do it the manual way or the old school way. It's like, you can still get results. Like you said, like you can go Google Maps it if you want to.
Yeah.
Or what's that other website? Indie on the Go. I remember I used to use that one a whole bunch back in the day.
Yeah, there's tons of databases out there already specifically for artists or promoters or whatever part of the industry you're in that have, like, you know, literally every venue in North America on there. Yeah. And at least like a info@email address to get in, you know. Yeah, there's,
that's why I like it.
I don't find much value in those, but and part of the not-for-profit I'm working on is working on a database with actual actual emails that go to people, not just like a
automated kind of
an inbox that nobody ever checks, or if they do check, they're not paying much attention to it.
Check it once a week,
that gets you that like one-on-one connection with somebody else. So we're offering that to, you know, all of our artist partners. Once that's, we get really the ball cool. rolling on that, that's one of the things that I think is super key for artists.
Absolutely. Like, just having that certainty of knowing if I'm going to take the time to like send out some emails, like I want to make sure that people are getting them, you know?
Exactly.
So that's really, and plus, you know, sometimes venues, you know, like as people have probably, some people maybe watching this have worked in a venue or just seen the people that work at the venue, there's turnover. You know, and so sometimes there's just like that email that got put up on Indie on the Move or whatever, that email may be good for a certain period of time, but then that person either goes to a new place, gets fired, there's a change, and all of a sudden the email's bunk. And but it's still there.
They don't set it to forward, you know, like, no. Like I don't want to like name any names or anything, but like I've worked for a lot of people through my years, and I literally still have email addresses that are active from businesses that I worked for 10 years ago.
Wow.
You know, it's like, you know,
no one's gonna see that.
Yeah, like it's like what, like the, you know, man. So, and also if you are a venue, make sure you like forward your email addresses when you have changeover in staff.
Yes.
You know, you're missing a lot of emails.
Yeah. Like there's it's not just good for us because we can actually reach out to potentially get a gig, but some venues need artists. Some venues are starving for just more talent, and you know, having that available is key. So yeah, please, if you're a venue owner, please make sure that all your emails are up to date, or at least they're forwarding to the up to date one.
Yeah. Yeah, but for sure there is a lot of database, like I said, a lot of databases online that you can subscribe to. Most of them are subscription now, as with everything.
Yeah.
But you know, there's some value in there. I would, maybe if you're just starting out, it'd be good to get it, but like only get it for like a year. You know, take the information that's pertinent to you, and you know, cancel the subscription. But you know, there's value in it. Like the information is all out there. All of the tools you need are out there, but I think AI really, really just like puts it all in one place.
That's I think the big value in it is that, well, AI has speed. It's like, for most people, like you said, you can have the paid subscription where you have access to the history and stuff. But for a lot of people, you can just use it for free. You know, so if you're a band on a budget and you want a free tool to help you make better decisions like that, I mean, OpenAI seems to be a very, very useful tool. I remember when me and my buddy,
while it's open, it's a really good tool. Like as with everything, it's going to, you know, become very commercial, very fast.
Yeah.
So like, that's another reason why you always have to be on like the front edge of this, you know, like those, you know, like if you're just getting into TikTok now, you're fucked. But you know, if you got in on the ground floor, you're probably doing all right if you have, you know, something that people want to see.
Yeah.
But you know, and like ChatGPT is like that right now. It's like that like initial boom of TikTok where there's a lot of people on it, and it's very open. There's nothing's paywalled right now. Well, there is, but it's minimal.
It's slowly creeping in. It's like the video game industry, you know. It was there for a while. It was just, you know, it was kind of there, and then it just became pay to progress in your games and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge gamer, but a lot of guys in my band are, and they talk about this issue all the time. It's like, I can't
the microtransactions.
Yeah, to me, that's something where like I get why the companies do it, because it helps their monetization, but I feel like it creates ill will with the consumer, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like you could, people like OpenAI, if they're not careful, could create something very similar there, where it's like,
well, they will. They will. Like that. That's the way.
It's a matter of when, as opposed to if. You know,
it happens all the time. You know, you saw it with like Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. Like all of these things kind of come in. They're pretty open, and then as they become popular, you know, marketers get involved, and it just becomes, you know, a club. And if you're not a part of that club, you're not paying into it. You're not going to be successful on it.
And that is true, where like the people who like get the most value out of social media, I don't think it's really like widely accepted this yet, but like I think like people need to understand that marketers are the ones that are benefiting the most from social media, because now all the people that they're trying to market their specific stuff to are in a place on the internet that they've self-congregated to. So now they can be so specific with their targeting and stuff. Like a lot of people are like, oh, this is a cool app because I can make funny videos with filters on it and stuff. Like that's all cool and stuff. But like the true value of the app is like the people that are paying the app to get their stuff in front of you. And I feel like as musicians, you know, we should utilize both the free and the paid versions of these things, where it's like, put out your content on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, you know, YouTube even, put it out there. And then also leverage the paid ads side of it. Be very careful. You know, for a lot of people out there that are new to paid ads, be very careful. Don't just go out there and have a $20 a day budget ad. You know, start real small and test.
Or hire, like, be careful of who you're hiring to manage that for you.
Absolutely. Because,
you know, if you get a marketing firm with, like, and you give them, like, a, you know, whatever, say a $4,000 budget, let's say.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, you know, they're going to put that on, and, you know, they, you know, unless they're like a music marketing company who like understands the ins and the outs of the industry and the exact people you're trying to market to, they're not going to hit your audience. Like, you putting those parameters in yourself as someone who knows the industry would. So, exactly. You know, you have to be careful about, like, if you're not doing it yourself as well, to, you know, make sure that you see their client list, what they've done for their other clients that are similar to you, as opposed to just like, oh, this marketing, they seem,
well, they have a website.
Yeah. And like, they seem pretty cool and we can afford them, but like, they're not going to give you anything really.
Because people think like a $300 ad campaign, like some musicians be like, well, that's a lot of money. I'm like, you'd be surprised how fast $300 can go.
That's nothing.
That's nothing.
Nothing.
That's nothing. I remember like the first week of promoting our music video, I think it was like we were doing Google ads and Facebook ads, and we hit $1,000 within a couple days. You know, like, and we were running for high traffic, high engagement and stuff. And another thing too that artists should think about if you're doing the paid ad thing is, where are you driving them that is going to liquidate your marketing cost?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's something that a lot of musicians haven't taken as much of advantage of, where it's like, even if you do something that's quote unquote free for the consumer, having a plan to monetize, like for example, having an advertisement that gets people onto an email list.
Yeah.
And then once they're on the email list, you immediately follow up with like, hey, do you want to get a physical copy of the CD? We'll sign it. It's X amount of dollars. And having some kind of offer that when people engage with the ad and actually sign up or whatever, you can monetize as quickly as possible. So you're not just spending hundreds of dollars to get new fans and not seeing anything immediately back.
Absolutely. Well, that's the whole name of the game of marketing, right? It's like, one, you want to put it in front of people. And then two, you want to sell them something, you know? So like, if you're not selling them something, like, what are you doing it for? Sure. You might get more followers or something on TikTok, but if that's what you want to do, cool. Yeah. But you know, you should have something to sell them outside of them just following you.
And even outside of just sending them to Spotify or Apple Music, because if you think about the numbers for every musician who's listening or watching right now, if you're getting paid 0.003 cents per stream, if it costs more than 0.003 cents to get someone to engage, then you're losing money no matter what. no matter, even if like everyone 100% that engages with your ad goes and listens to your song, you will still be paying more in marketing to get those people than the streaming revenue will bring in to counteract that.
100%.
So,
100%.
So if you're an artist out there, please don't just immediately run an ad to Spotify, because I mean, unless you're prepared to just eat that money, you know, unless you're prepared to just kind of light it on fire in a sense. I mean, sure.
You need some kind of return on investment, right? Like,
exactly.
Like you said, like if you're directing people to a Spotify or an Apple Music or whatever, Bandcamp, where you're not going to make any money, you know, it's better to spend on something that they will spend money on. Direct them to your merchandise page. Direct them to concert tickets.
Direct them somewhere.
Yeah, because if they come for a concert ticket, then they're going to buy that concert ticket. But when you get there, maybe they're going to buy your merch too. So like that's like the best possible way to direct them somewhere, I would say, would be your live show.
And, you know, there's kind of a weird push and pull with these two things of, like, to me, the pro of marketing, let's say, on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, is that the pool of people that you're putting yourself in front of is huge. If you do your targeting right, you can get yourself put in front of millions of people. That are really going to potentially be good fans. I do feel, though, it's harder through that medium to create that diehard relationship, whereas with a show, it's easier to create that diehard relationship because they're right there and you can kind of engage them more directly.
But
there's not as many people there. Your pool of people is a lot smaller because you can only convert who's at the show. You know, so maybe that's 100 people, maybe it's 50, maybe it's 300. That's your pool of the people to convert, so to speak. Where on the internet, the pool's bigger, but I feel like it's a little bit harder to get that sort of personal connection between fan and artist. Like, it can be done for sure, you know, but I feel like it's a little bit more difficult than a live show.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And to take that even further, you know, it's one thing to go play a show and have that connection with someone, blow them away, go out to the merch table after and meet everybody. You know, shake their hand, thank them for coming. You know, absolutely. That will build like a connection that's so strong. And
seriously,
they're going to be a fan for life, you know, and a lot of artists just don't do it, you know, but you're going to sell more merch. If you go out to your merch table after the show and you're shaking hands with everybody and meeting everybody, you're going to sell more merch and you're going to, you know, get them to come back next time.
Absolutely, because like that's the smallest one-on-one interactions with fans go so far. Like when you're an artist and you're on tour and you kind of get, it's easy to get desensitized, especially if you're on like a pretty decent bill and every night there's over 500 people there or something. It can be very easy to be like, oh, there's just some people there. I'm like, the smallest interaction, I'll tell a real quick story. One time I was on tour with a band called Smile Empty Soul back in the day. This is kind of when we were very first starting out, and we went through this town in Louisiana, and this couple saw us at the previous show, and then they traveled to the next show to see us, and we were just in the venue, kind of hanging out, getting ready for the show, like loading up, whatever, and I was on my way to the bathroom, and they were on their way leaving the bathroom, and I recognized them. I was like, hey, you were at the show yesterday, and I just came up and like gave him like a one-arm hug, like, hey, good to see you again. I hope, you know, I'm glad you came to the next one. They said that that moment was one of like the most special moments, because they were like, you just looked at me like we were friends or something, and we gave it. And I was happy to see them, because I'm always like, oh, wow, you came back. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, but just those little things like that, it doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
It's most likely going to be at the merch table.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're at the bar, or wherever.
That there is not like a strategy or anything.
No.
It's just like a general connection that you made with another human being.
Exactly. And
you
that's
know? And like if you go out to your merch table, you're going to make friends. You know,
that's
not sales, or they're not, you know, it's you're going to make friends, and you know, friends support each other, and it's, you know, if you, it's like I always say, like 90 and like this goes for everything you're doing in the music industry, whether it's selling your merch at the merch table, whether it's talking to a promoter about getting them to book you in their club, you have to make a connection with them, and you're like, you know, you're always a salesperson, and you're always a friend. You know, that's what you have to be.
Absolutely.
Like, if you're not that, you're not gonna, you know, you're not gonna get that like conversion or whatever marketing term you want to use for it. You know, like, you have to be a good fucking hang, and then that's just the bottom line, right?
That's so funny you say it like that. There's another guy who I think some people give him crap, but I think he actually puts out really good content. His name's Matt Bacon, and at Bacon Bits. I love that tag. That's so good.
It's a great tag.
But he was saying that like 90% of this business is about being a good hang.
Yeah.
And it's true.
It's like, very true.
And like you said, like, it's like you're always a salesperson. You're always a friend. I feel like that is so true. But like, a lot of artists, and I think it's not just artists, I think people in general have a sort of like a distance about sales, you know, because for me personally, I grew up, my mother was a furniture salesperson, and so was my dad.
Yeah.
So I grew around sales. And like, one time, like, I remember asking my dad, like, well, like, what is sales really? Because I know a bunch of people at school are like, all these people are coming in and they're just trying to get my money and blah, blah, blah. He's like, well, he's like, some salespeople can be like that. They can be pushy. He's like, but really, sales is just about helping somebody make a decision.
Yeah.
Giving them the information so that they can make a good decision based on what they want. And I was like, oh, yeah, that doesn't sound as dirty, you know, as the used car sales thing. And I think that's kind of true with like, with music and being a professional artist, is like, you're going to have to sell. That doesn't mean you have to be Billy Mays and be, you know, buy that for $29.95. You know, it doesn't have to be like that, but sales can be literally just like, let me show you what I got to offer. Let me show you the value in it. And if that's enough to make you say like, I want that, then cool. And if not, no hard feelings. You know, it's kind of like when people come up to the merch table and they just want to talk to you. I remember when I was very first starting out and I was a little too business focused, I would get mad if they came up and talked to me, but didn't buy me.
Yep.
I'd be like, what the hell?
I get that. Yeah.
You know, but then like, as I got older, I'm like, well, that's fine because I just made a new friend. I made a new like person. If I see at the show, but like, I talked to you for a little bit after that last gig, and odds are that they're going to buy something from you in the future.
Yeah.
So if they don't buy initially, it's like no reason to freak out and be like, oh, no one's buying anything. It's like, if you're out talking to people and making connections, they'll eventually support you.
100%.
You know? Sometimes people are just like, hey, I spent all my money at the bar. it could be something like, I wanted to get something.
But that's supporting you too, right? Because that's making the venue money, and they're the ones that are putting you there at the end
of
the
day. And that's true. It comes if you got it set up right. Yeah.
You know, times are tough, man. People don't have a lot of money. But they're at your show. So they spent the money to come to your show.
And that deserves praise.
Like, if you, exactly. I tour with a pretty prominent artist, and he does a meet and greet after every single show. And we're doing anywhere between 1,000 to 2,000 seat venues whenever we go out.
Awesome.
These things take over an hour a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
He signs whatever they want. He'll like, he takes photos with everybody. It's amazing to see. I've only been working with them for a few years, but the people who come to the meet and greet, they'll come with like a photo that they took like 10 years ago. And they're like, this was the first show that we came to see. And
that's
like,
awesome.
You know, like, it's like, so, and like, it's that connection that they've built over the years. I've never seen any artist connect with fans like that, but this guy is so genuine and he loves all of his fans and he loves that interaction. And it's served him so well.
That's so cool to hear that, man, because like, a lot of people think to be business savvy, you always have to have some sort of ulterior motive, and that's not true necessarily. It's really about serving people. I think it is. Music is about serving people. And like, one of the things I try to remind myself before I go out on stage is like, I'm out there to entertain those people. That's my job. You know, and I feel like sometimes people go up on stage, you know, I've only met like a handful of these artists, but you know, every industry has these kind of people that are going up on stage or doing the thing because they want the attention. Mm-hmm. They like it when people are looking at them, and it's really all about them, you know? Yeah. But when you are one of those people that you design your show around the idea of service, you design the show around the idea of like, what would just like blow the audience away?
Yeah.
There's a band, you may have seen them live or maybe not. If not, I definitely recommend checking them out. Their name is Nothing More.
Okay.
They have put on some of the best live shows I've ever seen. I'll put it this way. When I was younger and I initially heard their music, I was kind of a rock purist. Like if it had any kind of electro aspect or even hardcore production, I was like, no, it's not rock. And I heard their music and I was like, I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate it. You know, and then I saw them live because they happened to be on a bill of another show I was seeing. Their live show was so engaging and so entertaining that I was like instantly a fan for life. All my hatred for that band went away with a really, really good live show. And I feel like no band goes at it that way. It's like, or not no band. Most bands don't.
They try, they just can't execute it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a little bit of ego, right? Like
you're there
because you're doing it for yourself too, right?
Like it's
you have to do it for yourself and you have to do it for the fans. And
absolutely.
I think just to like kind of tie up everything we've been talking about for a little bit, you mentioned it's like it's people kind of when you talk about sales and stuff, like people are like,
oh, you're trying to sell me something.
Yeah. But like there's two, if you're like selling a phone plan to somebody, right? Like phone plans here in Canada suck, right? Uh-huh. Like we pay the most money for data plans. So whenever I get a call from like a telemarketing company about like telecom, I'm like, fuck right off. Right. But if I'm like at a show and there's like somebody at the merch table and they're just chatting, shooting the shit, it doesn't even feel like a sales pitch. And I'm there because I like that band. And, you know, they're giving me something honest and something that I'm already there for. So sell it, you know, like sell to those people, like, and don't be afraid to try to sell to them because you're already giving them something they want. And, you know, if what you're giving them is honest, no one's going to be upset about it.
Exactly. Like I've experienced this within myself. And then I've seen this with other people when I sell, because I sell outside of just my band. I have my own music related products where I sell books, I sell courses, coaching and stuff like that. And there's a nice moment when you're able to sell in such a genuine, authentic way that they're excited to make the purchase anyway.
Yes.
And that's, to me, that's the sweet spot. Like I remember we were on tour with Seven Dust a couple years ago, and we had a deal where me and the singer, we were sitting there like, okay, how do we structure this? So when someone comes up to the table, we can say, oh yeah, well, if you want this for $5 more, you get this and this, and it's a pretty nice little bundle. And it was like a shirt CD bundle.
Yeah.
That thing that to us initially was like, okay, how do we sell this in a way that it's a good value for them? When we started selling that at the table, people were like, for $5 more, I get both these things? And you're like, yeah, yeah. People were genuinely excited to purchase what we had to sell. And we were kind of, you know, selling it, but no one cared because one, we were happy someone was even at the merch table. So when someone comes up, it's like, thank you just for standing here and being here.
Especially when you're opening up for like, you know, a bigger band, you know.
Exactly. Like you didn't have to come over here.
Lined up around the venue and, you know.
Literally everyone's jam-packed to the front. You're like, I wonder if anyone's ever going to come over here. You know? But no, it ended up being like really, really nice where even if no one bought, you know, you show them that genuine, like, hey, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming over and like just being like, hey, I enjoyed your set because that's good feedback for us.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said earlier, it builds that.
I've seen a lot of times too, like when like just talking about like being support for another band, like a lot of times like bands like won't let you like the support have a merch table. Yep. So like, but you know, go out and just shake hands.
Seriously.
You know, if you can't sell something, yeah, like do something, give out business cards, whatever. You know, like just like QR codes for your social media, whatever you can do.
That's a good one.
Shake hands. Even if you can't, are unable to sell merch on a support tour. When we were talking about guarantees before, you know, and like people chasing like guarantees, it's like always there's ways to make things profitable that aren't necessarily putting dollars in your pockets, but it's like playing that long game and like, exactly. You know, just always just you have to have the business in mind. And a lot of these artists like aren't business savvy, right? That's like, that's a big problem. So there's just like, they'll just listen to people like us, right? Who are like trying to give advice. And like, honestly, 90% of the fucking advice I've been talking about probably won't work for you. But
you know, have like, to try, you know?
Like, yeah, it's trial and error and, you know, just being honest and, you know, being cool, and people will flock to that, and like something will work out for you if you just keep doing it, right? It's there's like everybody's offering advice and shit, and like, you know, like I hear it, I'm like, fuck, man, like that's like, you know, maybe there's a tidbit of good advice in what people say, but that's what I like about you. Like, I think you put a lot of thought into what you're doing.
I appreciate it.
There's not many people like you that I follow on TikTok, especially.
Well, I really appreciate that, man, because I have those moments before I record where I'm like, I could talk about this, I could talk about this, and I'm like trying to think like, what would be something that like hopefully someone could watch and then go do and see some kind of results, or at least, you know, like, because like you said, sometimes it's not even the strategy, it's just sometimes it's a time and place thing. Like sometimes you got a good strategy, but sometimes just like the time and place it got implemented just didn't work that time. You know, I've had stuff that worked like gangbusters at the merch table for certain shows, and then we do the same exact thing on the next show and it just doesn't quite click.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, like you said, like sometimes it can be a trial and error game, but you find out what works for you. You find out what works for your audience specifically. Because every audience kind of receives differently. You know, the black metal audience is going to receive different from the country audience, you know. But like figuring out what works for your audience, and like you said, just kind of like being genuine, you know, just being there to support people and have a good time and stuff. People will flock to that because they see that you're a genuine person.
Mm-hmm. You know? And especially too, like if like we talked about this before too, like, and this goes to, you know, like booking your own hall and selling your own tickets and stuff. Like, it's better for you to book your own hall in a city and sell 50 tickets than it is to go to a club and get a $400 guarantee where you're maybe going to get in front of 400 people. But, you know, those 400 people are only there because that's just the club they drink at or whatever.
Or like, they're there for like a headliner maybe, and you're the direct support.
So like it's, you know, just doing as much as you can for yourself and doing like, you know, DIY it or whatever. Or just have people in your corner that are really helping you out, you know, and building those relationships with a local promoter or a venue. And, you know, just, you know, be honest with them and just say like, look, this is what we're doing, this is what we want to do, you know, and like grow with that promoter. And like, you know, like, you know, maybe if you want to book your own hall, you know, bring that promoter in to like, you know, at least help with marketing or something. Like, just like, you know, keep those relationships going. You know, even if you do grow out of somebody, you know, like, cause you know, maybe that promoter needs help to get to the next level, and like building a community around yourself is super important. You know, just like always just be fucking cool, man. That's all you have to do, man. Just be cool with everybody you meet. And you know, you're going to go so far.
It's such a big deal of just being someone you can like hang around. I had a quick question kind of before we start to wrap things up. It was involved with the meet and greet setup. So my band, we've done meet and greets and hometown shows exclusively. And those have actually gone fairly well. Initially, you know, when you're not, you know, top 100 Spotify artists and you're offering a meet and greet, some people in the band were like, can we, like, are we even at a point where we can offer this? You know, like there's like a lot of hesitation. And so I was curious. It, with that artist that did the meet and greets after the show, have you seen a way to balance? Because there's kind of like two meet and greet sort of options. It's sort of the paid meet and greet before the show. And then there's just like the free hangout at the merch table meet and greet after the show. Yep. Have you ever seen an artist do both of those, or is it typically either one or the other? You know, and have you seen pros and cons to kind of either approach, you know?
You can do both. You can totally do both. I would never pay for a meet and greet, like, you know, like but that's just me.
Yep.
But you know, I've also just met so many musicians, and it's just like they're just
gotta people, demystify, right?
So like, it's like whatever. If I meet someone, cool. If not, whatever. Yep. But I took my dad to see Tommy Emmanuel.
Love Tommy.
My dad loves Tommy Emmanuel. I was working at the theater that he was coming into, our sister theater.
Okay.
So it was across the road. So I called up the front of house manager. I was like, hey, I'm bringing my dad to this show. Can we sneak him into the pre-show meet and greet? And this Tommy Emmanuel, like, he met with everybody, and like not only just met with people, but like people brought their like guitars to sign and stuff. And like Tommy Emmanuel picked up this kid's like clunky ass guitar that he'd never played before and just like noodled, and yeah. You know, Tommy Emmanuel'd it. And you know, it blew me away. And like, if you're offering something cool like that, I think you should, you know, like, you can get away with, you know, a paid meet and greet because you're adding value. It's like,
yeah.
That's a performance, right? That's a private, intimate performance.
Yes.
But like, you know, just charging people to meet them, like,
yeah,
it's not really cool. I don't
think. I think that's, you got it good.
That's my opinion. You know, other people would pay to meet, you know,
Beyonce
or whatever, right?
For sure. Like, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, if you're going to have that meet and greet, if you're going to have that, like, someone's basically paying to meet you, do something to make it more than just that.
Yeah.
You know, I think one thing, this is a habit I've gotten into.
A t-shirt, like.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Some kind of exclusive thing, yeah, that someone only gets because they're in the meet and greet. Like, one of the best things to do for artists out there, I think, to figure out if you're thinking about offering some kind of meet and greet or VIP thing, I look at what other bands do. I look, every time I see another band post, like, here's our VIP thing, I screenshot it, and I go, yep, throw it to a folder on my computer. So when we're putting together ours, I'm like, okay, what can we get away with?
Okay, yep.
And one of the best ones I stole from Beyonce. Like,
oh, yeah?
I was like looking at her. She had like a giant, it was her and Jay-Z did a
she's pretty successful.
Oh, she's killing it. And those VIPs were like $3,000. I'm like, oh my God. So we obviously can't charge that. But what if I could borrow the perk of a $3,000 meet and greet and put it into, yeah, my $60 meet and greet or whatever?
Yeah.
You know? And some of them was like exclusive parking. So we were like,
yeah,
maybe we can get to the venue and say, hey, some of our VIPs, part of the package is VIP parking. So can we like rope off or cone off specific parking in the front just for the VIPs?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh yeah, that's not that big of a deal. That's no problem at all. I'm like, awesome. We get to offer something Beyonce offers. But we don't have, you know, one, we're not charging $3,000.
Cool.
But two, we can pull it off. You know, so like thinking about if you're going to do meet and greets, how can you value add even more? You know, because like you said, it is kind of already a value add. But I think the people that do the best are people that go above and beyond. They over deliver.
Yeah. You know?
And I think that's the best way, I think, to do business in general, is just over deliver.
You know? Yeah. And, you know, be smart about it, you know,
yeah,
deliver on things that, you know, you know, maybe not give a t-shirt away, but like, you know, maybe like, you know, like a print of like some song lyrics or something, like something that's not expensive or like, you know, but like it's just something cool that they have as a collectible. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, don't break
throw in an NFT, you know,
like, yeah, whatever, man. But just like, it's like I said, it's just like give them something honest and they're, yeah, like they're not going to be upset about it.
I think We've talked a lot about some really good stuff today. I think if any artist or musician or industry person saw this, that they would get tremendous value from it, man. Well,
I hope so. And also, like, don't take anything that I say seriously.
we've got some grain of salt that you can take whenever you're listening to us. But, you know, we're just two dudes who have been in the industry and seen some stuff.
Yeah.
And we report back to y'all and share our experiences. And like you said, like, sometimes someone else will try something and it doesn't really work for them. But I think just being aware of what's out there, being aware of your strategies, being aware of your options. And
yeah,
I think it provides so much value. That's the benefit of living in this day and age, the information age. You know, literally if any artist has a question about something, odds are you can find it, you know. I mean, I say this as a course creator, but I still stand by it because I think there is value in the aggregation of information, you know, because while we all can throw some elbow grease down and just go find the info, sometimes to go find all the info takes 20 hours to get every piece of information you need, whereas I would rather just, I'll pay 40, 100, 200 bucks to get all the information I need, just condensed in order how I need it, you know. So those are also tools that artists and musicians can use. Like, I've purchased a bunch of courses, whether it was like a songwriting course, a guitar course, a music business course, a personal financial literacy course, like just to know, you know, I feel like those things can be really valuable as well. But
just to add to that, you know, like it goes back to something we were talking about earlier too, with like, you know, making sure you're getting those guarantees, you know, like, and like, let's look at festivals that have like the pay to play like model, right? Like it fucking sucks, right?
Yes.
But there are some festivals out there that have that pay to play thing, or like pay to submit, but some of them have a conference attached to them. So if you get to play at the festival, you get access to all the conference part of it as well. That's a huge value. That's especially if you're a starting band, you know, it's your first couple of years, you know, you don't really have any industry people in your corner. Those conferences have way more value to emerging artists than any club guarantee show would ever give you.
Wow.
So when people talk shit about pay to play stuff, some of them suck. Like I said, grifters are going to grift, but there are some festivals out there that have a really cool conference attached to them, where there's going to be a panel full of music industry professionals that you're going to get to meet.
Yeah.
Not only just listen to what they have to say, but they hang out after and shake some hands. There's so much value in that. So one of the things I always tell people is to look to get at those festivals. And the other thing too is, if it's, especially if it's in a cold market for you, it's going to give you a little foothold in that market, that you can maybe play a few shows at, something like, South by Southeast or whatever like that. Or up here in Canada, we have Canadian Music Week in Toronto, North by Northwest, all that kind of stuff.
That's funny, man. Just living in the South, I'm so used to South by Southwest that I forget that there's all these other North by Northwest and, you know.
Yeah, we're doing stuff here in Canada too, eh?
Yeah, man. Man, we need to get back up to Canada, man. It'd be cool to meet and hang and maybe
for sure
a show or something, you know. That'd be super fun, man.
Yeah, man, if you guys are planning to come up, just let me know. I'll help you guys out however I can, man.
Yeah, because that's definitely a colder market for us. So yeah, well, I'll if we go to
Canada, I got lots of strategies for people coming to Canada.
Awesome. That's awesome, dude. Well, man, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and talk about all this.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being on here.
Dude, absolutely, man. I always love having conversations with fellow industry professionals that have seen stuff, know cool tricks, and I think you shared some really, really cool stuff today. So, dude, thanks again for this, and we'll hopefully get to do it again some other time, man. It'll be...
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's been great getting to know you over social media, and hope to chat with you more soon.